Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the long-lasting power you need with Energizer. Menards has the largest in-stock selection of Energizer batteries. They provide solid power for flashlights, remotes, and so much more. Right now, save big on Energizer batteries. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield and this is Drop Dead Serious. You know, it's been almost 3 years since four University of Idaho students were slaughtered inside their home at 1122 King Road. And it's been almost 3 weeks since Brian Koberger was sent off to the Idaho Maximum Security Institution to begin serving a sentence for the rest of his natural life for committing those murders. But tonight, we've got some new details about what Brian Koberger may have said while he was inside that house as he was carrying out his slaughter, specifically which victim he may have named. We also have some information about what Koberger was doing right after the murders. Spoiler alert, he called his mommy. He called his mother within 2 hours of butchering those kids, and he didn't just call her one time. Wait until you hear how many times and how many hours he spent on the phone with his mommy right after stealing those kids from their moms. And thanks to digital forensics and an expert duo who was tasked with analyzing Koberger's phone and his electronics, we have learned some very creepy details about Koberger and his relationship with his parents. It is all very unsettling, and frankly, it is giving Norman Bates in the movie Psycho vibes, through and through. And we've just discovered some amazing details about what these forensic analysts found and what they did not find in his electronics that the rest of us all have in ours. Like, you will not believe the number of contacts Brian Koberger had saved on his phone. I don't know about you, but I have upwards of 5,000. I use my phone for everything. I use it for work, and I'm a journalist. I've got contacts coming out the yin-yang for 35 years, 38 years, who's counting? And I'm guessing you have hundreds, maybe you have thousands as well of contacts in your phone. Brian Koberger, you could fit every one of his contacts into a Sprinter van. Also new, we're learning about a book that Koberger owned and passages that he highlighted on page 118. And let me tell you, it's very, very informative about who he was and what he was thinking. Heather Barnard and her husband, Jared Barnard, are the expert duo who led the team tasked with examining Brian Koberger's phone and his hard drive. And they discovered that less than 2 hours after the murders, at 6:13 a.m., Koberger picked up his phone and he called his mommy. But there's a twist here. There's a really weird, like I said, Norman Bates-like twist here, and I'll have more on that in a minute. But remember, Koberger's white Elantra was seen on surveillance video tearing out of that neighborhood where 1122 King Road sits, like a bat out of hell. That was at 4:20 a.m. So again, less than 2 hours after he slaughters four innocent college kids, he's calling his mom. Now, we have seen some of the details in motions that were filed by the state and the defense leading up to Brian Koberger's trial, a trial that, of course, never happened because he just went ahead and pled guilty. But here's what's new. The Barnards, the digital forensics team, said that Koberger's digital breadcrumbs showed that he had a strange way of referring to his parents. For one thing, he saved them in his contacts as mother and father. not mom and dad the way most of us do. And okay, maybe that's not so weird, but what is bizarro is that those are the same names he used to talk to them and text with them. For example, here's a text that Brian sent his dad. Father, why didn't mother pick up when I called her? Think about that. You're texting your dad and you're calling him father and you're referring to mother. Why didn't mother pick up the phone when I called? Again, it just strikes me as Norman Bates from the movie Psycho. And I don't think I'm the only one. In any case, those digital breadcrumbs also revealed that when Brian Koberger called mother at 6:13 a.m., he didn't get an answer. So 1 minute later, he called father. And the Barnhearts say that this was actually a habit of Koberger's. He would call mother first, and if she didn't answer, he'd call father right away. And he would go back and forth like this. And here's another actual text. Father, why did mother not respond? Why is she not answering the phone? It's just bizarre. Well, eventually that morning, mother did answer the 6 a.m. calls, and their conversation lasted 36 minutes. And not long after that call, he called mother again. And this time they talked for 54 minutes. But here's where it gets so dark and so upsetting and just frankly so incredibly weird. Those 54 minutes that he was on the phone with his mother the second time, again, first time, it's just 2 hours after the murders. The second time, those 54 minutes overlap with the time that Koberger was driving back to Moscow, back to the King Road murder scene. Do you remember when we were in the change of plea hearing for Koberger and the Latah County prosecutor, Bill Thompson, said that the killer spent about 10 minutes back at the crime scene right around 9 a.m., right? At 9 a.m., it's still real quiet. The roommates are still downstairs in the basement. They do not know what's on the second and third floor of the house. They do not know the bloodbath that has happened. They think some weird stuff happened that night, but they have no idea that a quadruple murder happened. At 9 a.m., it's quiet in the neighborhood, at the house, but Koberger is back there. He's back there. And I think we all know why, right? Really good bet. He's back there looking for the knife sheath that he now knows he left behind. And oh shit, that thing is going to lead right back to me. That is a colossal mistake. That is worth me risking going back to the scene of the crime in the bright and early morning hours. Wow. Talk about unbelievable balls or unbelievable fear. But he's on the phone with his mother at the time he's going back to the place he killed the kids. All I keep thinking about is, what did mother hear in the background? Right? She's on the phone and he's skulking around that property. And we all know now what he did, right? He went up the side road, parked in that back parking lot area, scrambled down the embankment and went in the back sliding glass door at the back of the house and went out the same way he came in. So he's thinking, maybe, God, I hope, did I drop that sheath outside? Will I find it outside? God, please let it be that I dropped it outside, not inside. Because there's no way in hell I can go back into that house. I left some of those girls alive. So he's skulking around. Mom's on the phone. And the leaves are crunching under his feet. And the twigs are breaking. It's November. It's fall in Idaho. Snow is falling, actually, you know, periodically in those days. So is mom hearing all the crunching? All the walking around? What's he telling her? What's he telling her? Why are you outside? Where are you, Brian? What are you doing? Oh, I'm just out for a walk, Mom. In the place where I slaughtered four people. Anyway, what are you up to? What are you and Father up to? Here's what I really believe. I'm a mother. I don't think that he told her anything about what he'd done. Because as a mother and as a father, I don't think there's any way in hell they wouldn't have been on a plane that day out to get him. Instead, it was almost 6 weeks, I think, until Dad finally flew all the way to Idaho to drive all the way back with him. And if your kid had told you anything of these horrors, you wouldn't just wait 6 weeks and drive out to pick him up. I really honestly believe in my heart there's no way that Mrs. Koberger was being told anything of substance. Maybe she's being told that he's feeling off or upset or he needs comforting in some way or he's agitated or something, whatever the bullshit is he fed her. She definitely thinks that something's wrong because how could you be normal? How could you be at all the same person after you commit that kind of a horror? Anyway, so the digital experts, the Barnharts, say that Koberger is still on the phone with his mother at 9 a.m. and that the call lasted another 9 minutes. So he's at that house skulking around for 9 minutes with mom on the phone. Calls his mom within 2 hours of the slaughter. Calls her again while returning to the crime scene in the morning. Got to imagine, like, what is going through this guy's head? What's he in need of? What comfort does this monster need from mommy or mother? And that wasn't all. Two more calls came later in the day. A two-minute conversation he had with his mom at 4:05 p.m. And then another call at 5:53 p.m. And guess how long it lasted? 96 minutes, an hour and a half, almost 6 o'clock at night. And this call is an hour and a half. And at this point, you know the news is already broken, right? You know that the shit hit the fan in Moscow. You know that the news is all over it. You know that Pullman, Washington and Moscow, Idaho are just alive with the reporting of the Truman Capote-styled in cold blood murders that have happened just off of campus. So you know it's now big news, and Brian knows it. He's seeing it. And he's calling his mommy right before 6 o'clock. By the end of the day, the same day that those four young lives were cut short in the most brutal and sadistic ways, Koberger and mother had spoken for over 3 hours. And in case you're curious, the digital experts said they could find no text messages with friends. They found no social plans on his phone, no chatter with anyone outside his family, just a benign group chat. That was it. Here's the really big piece. According to the digital experts, Brian Koberger had only 18 contacts saved in his phone. 18. You just imagine that 18 is your whole social circle. And some of those contacts were people that he hardly even knew, if at all. Didn't even list them as a name, just kind of like a description, like somebody I ran with, someone with the hair.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Barnhart said that Koberger's digital data showed that he had sometimes called his mother as early as 4 o'clock in the morning. I talked with this forensics team on my News Nation show, Banfield. Big shout out to News Nation and the amazing team I work with. We're on at 10 p.m. Eastern, so if you ever get a chance, please check our show out. And here's what Heather and Jared Barnhart had to say about their work on Brian Koberger's Samsung phone and the rest of his electronics. Our conversation was absolutely fascinating, to say the least. Have a listen. Heather and Jared, thank you so much. Wow, I have wanted to talk to you guys for a couple of years now. So, Heather, let me start with you. He called his mother within 2 hours of the murders. He called his mother as he returned to the scene of the crime, not even 2 hours later. He called her two more times and all told spent 3 hours on the phone with her. Was this out of character? Was this a binge of calls to mom that you were able to identify on his telephone?
This was his normal behavior. Reaching out to mother and father repeatedly. If one didn't respond, he would reach out to the other. He would constantly text them and call them starting as early as 5 or 6 in the morning, his time. And his parents were Eastern. And then also at night to almost talk him into going to sleep and being able to rest.
So, Jared, as I was looking at some of the text messages, I was so, I don't know, I was just jarred by the way he referred to his parents. He texted them. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the wording is pretty close. Father, why is mother not answering the phone? Why is she not picking up, father? He called his parents formally by the names father and mother when speaking to them. Did you see that consistent throughout his text messages to his parents?
Yes, I did. It's eerie. It stands out from any other case that I've worked in that just the terminology, the phrasing that he used there. I said exactly what you said in the intro. It's Bates Motel. It is this feeling of that movie and mother, and it's just super eerie.
Yeah, I mean, I thought maybe I'm the only one, but I'm starting to get that vibe from you, from my colleagues, from people I've been talking throughout the day about this. Some people do use a formal name, but knowing what he's capable of now, knowing who he is, it just raises the hair on my arms. About the contacts in his phone, he called his father, and mother as contacts in his phone. But what about other contacts, Heather? What about other text chains, other communications? Did this guy have any community of his own?
He had 18 personal contacts. 18. So think about all the people you meet and the hundreds of random numbers. And they were even identified as girl I ran with, second girl I ran with, a contact and in parentheses hair. But then there was mother and father and his sister and just a few others. 18.
And he's, you know, he's in his 30s. Like this, that's unbelievable at this, in this day and age. It is not unusual for people to have well over 1,000 contacts, many thousands of contacts at this stage in our lives. Everything is on our phones. Everything's digital. What about text chains? Did you see any communications with other people other than mother and father?
Not really. No, it was, I couldn't name a single person that he communicated with other than just his parents. There was some one-off communications here and there, and there was some emailing and other things. But for texting, if you think of the friend that you sent a message to on a whim, there wasn't one single person like that.
And I know that we learned during the final hearings before he was sent packing to the Idaho Maximum Security Institution that he had done quite a job at scrubbing a lot of his devices. How good a job, and how were you able to get past some of what he thought he put over on you?
This was one of the hardest investigations I've ever worked in 23 years of looking at digital data. He cleaned up well. He knew how to use VPNs. He knew how to use incognito browsing. Where he messed up, downloads on his Android device. He also didn't consider the fact that even on a PC, if you delete, every contact leaves a trace. So we can see the files when you turn something off. We can see when you clear something. All of that was left behind for us.
Let me ask you this. The handshakes that we now find are so helpful in digital forensics when killers don't realize they're connecting to a Wi-Fi where they're not supposed to be. Did he have a lot of questionable digital handshakes, like say at the Mad Greek restaurant where two of the victims worked? Did you see anything that was of interest or evidentially helpful with his digital handshakes?
Yeah, I'll break that down sort of with two parts. So his Wi-Fi connections, there were just a few. And the interesting part about this is 2 days prior to the murders, he turned off Wi-Fi for his phone. So he just didn't want his device to be able to connect to Wi-Fi. It turned back on soon after the murders. But there was one reference to Mad Greek, and it came from a passive assist file associated with Google Maps. So if you open Google Maps and you search for restaurants near me, if you're near Mad Greek, it would populate, and that reference was then logged on his phone.
And then the other question I have for you is, we just looked at that selfie. We had it up on the screen that he took within hours of the murders. He's freshly washed and he's got the thumbs up. He looks like he's in a bathroom and he looks extremely proud. Were you able to ascertain anything about that photo? Did he manipulate the photo? Did he screen grab it bigger? Did he rest on it for, you know, hours or minutes? Did he send it to anyone? Did you see anything of interest about that picture?
So this photo jumped out to us right away. And I remember us asking the FBI at the time, have you seen this? And they said, yes, we found that already. We're like, okay, but look at his knuckles and how white they are. To us, it looks like someone that scrubbed them and had to get something off, maybe blood or some kind of residue off his knuckles. Also, the Band-Aid on his finger was there. In that image, you can see a shower curtain. In later images that he had taken, the shower curtain from his apartment was gone. So just small details like that, but we didn't see, he didn't have friends to send this to. And I don't think it's a photo that he would have shared with mother or father. We didn't see any manipulations or access to printing. So it's almost as if he did this and several other selfies of similar nature, but with fewer clothing for himself.
Yeah, it was normal for him to take selfies and do nothing with them. They weren't sent to a person.
So let me be clear. We've only seen this selfie on the morning of the murders. Did you find other selfies that he took of himself, either in the bathroom or elsewhere, the morning of the murders or that day?
No, not the morning of the murders. Just in general, his selfies that he would take, he would often take, like flexing his muscles and shirtless. But again, we have no idea what he did with them. It was just a photo that was taken, and there's no evidence that he was sending them to anyone. It's just kind of for himself.
Well, the bandages that you noticed on his left, I think that's his left hand, unless the photo is reversed. But someone in the class also said in police documents today that they noticed he came to class shortly after the murders. And of course, they don't know about the murders. They're just looking back in hindsight to October, late October. And they said he came in with his two middle fingers bandaged and said, oh, he had just had some accident inside his home. One last aha moment that the two of you had, Heather and Jared. He said that his alibi was that he was going to be out stargazing that night, you know, out in the middle of the night, stargazing. But you found something about the phone that would have absolutely obliterated the alibi. Can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah, it seems silly to even write it. But on the night of the murders, he physically pressed the side button and turned his phone off. And that might not seem too significant, but it really is, because it proves that this human was awake at 2 whatever in the morning and turning his phone off and then later powering it back on. And the crazy part was writing in a report that a phone can't take photos while it's powered off, but just to prove that his alibi was ridiculous. But he turned his phone off and then these people were murdered and then he turned it back on. That's what happened.
Well, and also, he turned the phone off at 100%, so he could never say the phone just died. Phone was fully batteried up. Heather and Jared Barnhart, I cannot thank you enough for this interview. I could talk to you for hours and hours. I'm going to have you back as well. Thank you for helping us sort of sort through a lot of this. Really appreciate it. And something else that these digital experts have not shared before, on December 30th, that was the day that Koberger was arrested. On that same day, his phone pinged with an email notification, and that notification read, "New message from Reddit. Your account has been permanently suspended for posting violent content." The account name? Criminology_student. Heather Barnhart said that Brian had been posting in forums for ex-cons and prison inmates looking for volunteers to interview about their crimes. One user even messaged him directly, quote, "Saw your post on Reddit. Still looking for volunteers?" It's not that we hadn't heard this before, right? We knew that as a criminology student, he was out soliciting all sorts of creepy questions about, tell me what it felt like when you're committing your crimes. What was very odd about it was that he was no longer a student when he was putting out that questionnaire. So was he just a student of life at that point? A student of taking lives at that point? But what a coincidence, right? That Reddit booted him off the platform the very day that his family home in Pennsylvania was raided and Brian Koberger was led away in cuffs. It makes me wonder if the news was so big, because I remember those headlines. I remember being on vacation and being ripped into a studio in Florida somewhere to do this news endlessly all day long, that there's been an arrest in the Idaho murders. Who the hell is this Koberger guy? I remember it so well. But since it was wall-to-wall news, maybe Reddit did a quick look. Maybe they said, yikes, let's make sure we don't have him on our platform. And maybe they found him real fast and pinged him off even faster. Because I can't imagine that it's just a coincidence on December 30th that, we just, you know, weirdly found these very violent, you know, postings. Bye. And interestingly, they weren't that violent. They were just, you know, the musings and questions of what would be considered a normal criminology study. I think Reddit knew exactly who this guy was and wanted them the hell gone. I should tell you, we also learned a whole lot more new information from about 600 pages of new police documents that News Nation just obtained. And buried within those documents, something we had never heard before. You might remember one of the surviving roommates, Dylan Mortensen. She did over a half dozen interviews with the police about what she saw and what she heard the night of the murders, when she was the only eyewitness to the shadowy figure all dressed in black with the mask and the bushy eyebrows.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
I have read all of her interviews with the police, and Dylan was remarkably consistent in all of them. But there was one statement to police that contained something different, something extraordinarily revealing, if Dylan's memory is correct. Dylan Mortensen told police that she heard Brian Koberger say the following: "It's okay, Kaylee. I'm here to help you." When I read that, I had to look again. I thought, that's a mistake. That's a typo. That's not what's been in all the documents leading up to now. But that reference in that interview to the police on that day, it's an actual reference to one of the murder victims, Kaylee Gonzalez, and the first time we're ever hearing that Koberger might have even known one of the students he killed. Maybe it means that Kaylee was the target, or maybe at least one of the targets. Here's what the document actually said verbatim. Quote, "Sometime in the early morning hours, redacted," meaning Dylan, "was awoken and opened her room door and heard a male say," quote, "It's okay, Kaylee. I'm here for you," end quote. And crying. She then shut the door. A short while later, she opened her door again and saw someone approximately 5'10" tall, dressed in black with a ski mask, standing in the kitchen. End quote. Now, this could be a mistake, right? It could be a mistake that she made that was corrected in her later interviews, because every other version of her interview that she gave, we've heard Dylan saying that she heard a voice saying, quote, "It's okay, I'm here to help you." But no name, certainly no reference to Kaylee. "It's okay, I'm here to help you. It's okay, Kaylee, I'm here for you." Maybe the okay got mixed up with Kaylee, but the fact that Kaylee's name appears in a police document at all, that Dylan once told them she heard the killer mention Kaylee's name, I mean, it's nothing short of jaw-dropping, because otherwise we have no connection between Koberger and these kids. The police found nothing. That was the biggest revelation when the documents and the gag order, the gag order fell, the documents started to drop. We thought for sure we'd learn why. What was it? Why did he do this? Why did he pick them? Why did he go to that house, those kids? But they said they could find nothing. He was just too good at scrubbing. Something else we found out today. There's a piece of evidence that's been quietly stashed in the police evidence lockup. A book. The Idaho State Police, the lead investigator, Lieutenant Darren Gilbertson, says that the book that they seized after raiding Brian Koberger's properties was heavily highlighted on page 118. Up until now, we never knew what the book was. We knew a book had been seized, but we didn't know what the book was called or what kind of book it was. And some of us had theorized, I certainly did, that it was the manifesto of Elliot Rodger, an incel spree killer who espoused misogyny in his writings and maybe was the inspiration for Papa Rodger, although the police say, nope, no connection, just awfully coincidental. But the book they seized was actually a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. It's a book authored by Susan Jeffers, an author who's now deceased. It's a self-help book about turning anger and indecision into action. Lieutenant Darren Gilbertson told the Idaho Statesman that he doesn't know what Koberger underlined or what he marked in that book on page 118, but that the book is still in evidence. So we looked at the book and we turned to page 118 and we found an interesting summary at the top of that page. And here's what it reads. "The knowledge that you can handle anything that comes your way is the key to allowing yourself to take risks." This is from a self-help book about turning anger and indecision into action. So was this Koberger trying to improve his life in a positive way? Or was this Brian Koberger working up the nerve to slaughter unsuspecting victims while they slept? One thing we can tell you for sure, Koberger was on a quest to learn as much as he could about pulling off the perfect crime. And there's a trove of new information about that in this new batch of documents obtained by News Nation. The documents show that even before the quadruple murders at the University of Idaho, Brian Koberger was already setting off alarm bells in Pullman, Washington. That's where he was, of course, a doctoral student in criminology at Washington State University. Fellow grad students of his and the professors who were there, they've described Koberger as difficult in the past. We knew that. But this new information in these documents takes it to a whole other level. It turns out that the red flags were actually a crimson tide when it came to Koberger. One professor says that staff actually pulled her aside and asked her to check in on a female grad student because Koberger had been hanging around her in an uncomfortable way. Sometimes he would physically block the office door where several women were inside working. That professor said that more than once she'd hear a female student say, quote, "I really need to get out of here." And that professor would then step in the room, walk right into that office and give that student kind of an opening, you know, to leave and to get out the door. And in class, Koberger was fixated, laser focused on burglars And not just any burglars. He was obsessed with separating the regular kind of burglar from the sexually motivated kind of burglar. And then almost like clockwork, he'd steer the conversation back to serial killers over and over again. Students and teachers all told the police that Koberger dominated every conversation he was in, that he had to dominate it, that he had to take over every conversation, that he made it uncomfortable for everybody around him, that he mansplained all the topics, even to men, even to teachers, even to people who he would explain the research that they were actually doing. Apparently, he was so off-putting, people said they avoided being around him. He had three courses in his PhD program, two of them taught by women, one of them taught by a man. And obviously a pattern started to develop with Brian Koberger that all the kids got together and decided to do a little survey because they noticed a pattern. Koberger was routinely late to the female taught classes, but never once late to the male professors' classes. So when they actually ran the numbers, it bore out. Never once late to the male professor. Late all the time to the women who taught classes. Some of the female grad students even reported to that same professor that when Koberger was not in class, they said, quote, "Oh my God, class was so much better today. It's just easier to navigate when he wasn't there." The classroom was set up in a circle formation, and Koberger would always take the seat right next to the professor, always. That professor later told colleagues that she was genuinely worried that if he ever got his PhD, quote, he would be a predator. Let me just repeat that. One of Brian Koberger's professors was so worried that if this guy got his PhD, he would be a predator. And the other scary thing is that she said there's no way he can't get his PhD. He's way too smart. We have to give him that PhD at the end of this program. And in a faculty meeting right before Christmas break, this professor flat out said these words, quote, "Koberger is smart enough that in 4 years, we will have to give him a PhD. Mark my word, I work with predators. If we give him a PhD, that's the guy that years from now, we'll hear is harassing, stalking, and sexually abusing his students," end quote. Just imagine this. This is what they were talking about. The professors were meeting about this together, fearing we're teaching this guy and he's going to be a predator. Look, they talked amongst themselves. They were very serious about trying to figure out ways to stop the process, roll it back, get rid of him. They talked about cutting the funding to his program so that they could kick him out. Not everybody agreed because, let's be frank, he's weird. He's an asshole. Nobody thinks he's a quadruple murderer. So in the end, that didn't happen. What is remarkable about a group of professors deciding amongst themselves if they should pull funding and get rid of a student is that at Washington State University, according to one professor, in all of her time there, it had never been on the table before for a grad student to be kicked out like that. They had never before, in her experience, pulled funding to get rid of a student that they thought was dangerous. And the reason is they believed that he was already stalking people, but they couldn't be completely sure. One professor reported that he had followed her while walking to her car. Apparently it frightened her so much that the next time she asked for an escort to walk her to her car. And a grad student even reported that somebody had broken into her apartment and stolen intimate items like perfume and underwear, and she was scared. Another grad student remembered meeting Koberger at a faculty barbecue before classes even started. She said he was instantly off-putting, spoke in a robotic tone, and then tried to lecture her about her own research. After that, she avoided him, only making the bare minimum of hallway small talk. And then there was the student who said Koberger would follow people to the parking garage or just linger, standing there uncomfortably after conversations. Things got so concerning, the department actually held a mandatory discrimination and harassment training for all grad students just because of Brian Koberger. But again, you got to put yourself in the headspace of back then. Freaky, weird, odd, mansplains, asshole, domineering, rude to women. But was it enough to get rid of him? So 600 pages of documents and an interview with these forensics experts who, you know, reamed his phone and his electronics. And I am overloaded with stuff I never knew about this case. The fact that he called his parents mother and father. I just remember back to the sentencing where he mouthed to his mother, "It's okay, mother," but then ended up leaving the courtroom, ignoring both his mother and his sister who traveled across the country to be there for him. Didn't even look their way. The fact that a professor believed in the future he was going to become a predator. That they just kept teaching him more and more information to become a PhD level predator. The fact that we heard it's possible Dylan Mortensen heard Brian Koberger say, "It's okay, Kaylee, I'm here to help you." Maybe she changed her mind later in the interviews, but that interview's on paper and she said it. All of this we're processing as I keep thinking about how many sleepless nights Brian Koberger is having now and will have in the future at the Idaho Maximum Security Institution. They're banging on the doors. They're yelling through the ducts. They're taking turns and shifts to make sure the harassment of Brian Koberger goes on all day and all night. The inmates organized this themselves. They knew he was coming and they planned it themselves. And Koberger's asking the guards for help. Wah. But doesn't look like the guards are doing anything for him. And the institution, when News Nation called to ask, "Is it true? What's happening?" They said, "We're aware of Brian Koberger's complaints about the way the other inmates are communicating with him. But inmates communicate like that. But he's safe." Meaning, unless you're getting physically assaulted, you're good. Deal. And Brian, mother cannot help you in there. I'm Ashley Banfield. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching and listening. And remember, the truth isn't just serious. It's drop dead serious.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.